And welcome to This Is Whole Life. As you may know already, this is the weekly podcast from the Whole Life Church in Orlando, Florida, where every week we get together and talk about what's happening here at the church, mainly what we're discussing from the pulpit, if you will, even though we don't really have
a mouthful, isn't it, Randy?
Well, I started down.
This week left you tongue-tied?
Pulpit came to mind, and I'm like, well, we don't really have a pulpit. And then I was like, that just doesn't sound whole life-ish, pulpit.
No. From the iPad stand.
But from the Word, because Ken doesn't, you know, he doesn't have an iPad. He has his Bible up there. Got a few notes here and there to keep him
still old
square.
School.
Still
yeah.
old school. Which is refreshing. So, speaking of which, Ken Wetmore, it's the summer of Wetmore. You'll learn more about that at the very end as we clue you in on a few things that are upcoming. Our lead pastor to my right, and then across the table is Melanie Bachman, our worship pastor. And Lucas the Great to my left, assistant communication director, and me, Randy. We are here to talk of this week about, and I'm sad, I've got tears inside that we're done with Ruth in 4 short weeks.
Yeah, it went quick.
4 short chapters, 4 short weeks. Faithful servant of God this week as we wound it down. And really, we've said this every week, but I also feel like it's totally, like, they deserve it. Tamsin and Ellie doing Naomi and Ruth, like, yeah. the drama really made this series kind of come alive in a way that it just doesn't if you don't have somebody. And not every message is ready for drama team to come up and do something.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think every message.
Yeah,
I really feel like we could do it.
All right, drama team, you've been challenged by Ken to make it happen.
Well, I'm going to need to consult with my esteemed script writer, Tammy.
And Melanie's like, where am I getting all this extra time from in the service?
Don't worry about it. Just
do it. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. I'm not sure, but I think it could be. But this week, Tamsin played Naomi and Ellie played Ruth. And it really, the way that it was written and kind of showing the unity in their thought as they, you know, shared parts of sentences to bring their stories together, really was a nice way to get started and bring home the point of none of this works if both of them aren't willing to direct, to guide, maybe to bend a little in places that they weren't sure that they could or maybe should. And it really made you feel, before Ken said a word, like, oh man, this really shows them maybe the solidarity they had together. Like, we're going to make this work. Mm-hmm. And it almost felt like this is a good plan. No, maybe this is a great plan. But lots of emotion. And it really made it feel like the Book of Ruth kind of coming alive for a little bit. That was really cool. And I was thinking about one of the last lines Ken mentioned in week 3 about how Naomi was so sure that Boaz, like, my guy is going to get it right. I know this guy. I know him. He's not going to let the sun go down without making this work. And then right as we get started in the next message, he has to go talk to the other person that's ahead of him in line. And instead, he needed 2 witnesses, and I don't know, I guess I missed this in my reading of this before, but Boaz brings 10. Like, yeah. I'm almost wondering, is this like I'm bringing my posse and I'm bringing a ton of people, and was this high pressure or was this just we're serious, we want to make sure nothing is left undone, or I really want Ruth, and if this joker says yes, I'm going to throw the other 8 on top of him and just pound him until Ruth is back to me.
Not that one. Not that one.
Yeah, not that one?
No, not that one. I, you know.
But we'll never really know, though,
well,
right?
That's what I'm
well,
saying.
Well, I feel like on this one, we're pretty sure.
Ken's pretty sure on this one. Okay. Why?
We do know that the sin of certainty is out there, but we're going to go with, we're pretty sure it was not a...
It would be a character arc deviation.
Mm-hmm. That's true. We didn't see any violence or any subterfuge or anything like that. Well, a little
maybe
bit.
Maybe a little subterfuge.
Yeah, a little bit. I was just going to say, wait a minute, that's probably not an accurate statement given the feet situation. But
not physical violence.
Anyway.
You really want that, don't you, Randy?
I do.
How was your weekend? Is there anything we need to unpack? I heard you had a complete oar on yours, so I don't know that. This is a little inside joke for those of you who are Lucas and Randy are friends enough that they actually went out boating or paddling or something, and they got into some kind of oar war.
Well, the oar war was close to me, and they were almost in Crocodileville.
Yeah.
Or Gatorville, I should say. And it was windy, and they were it was actually him and Ellie having a water fight in Lucas's oar can't went in the water with the whole oar and came back with a part missing. The most important part, the actual end of the oar that helps you propel across the water.
So it was a long, long
it was a
half
long,
oar
exactly.
trip back. Yeah, there we are. So
it was like a canoe.
So that wasn't even you, Randy. So are you feeling so maybe?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I was a little left out of the violence, and so maybe that was
maybe that's it.
That's possible, but. Lucas did paddle the rest of, well, we paddled about 2 miles.
2 miles,
give or take.
With an oar.
We have an oar.
And I was like, look, here's the J stroke, just in case you're not you didn't go to summer camp like some of us. I'm going to give you the J stroke. That way you know that you can just stay going straight with only one oar, not the other half. And he was like, nah. He just kept sticking the round part in the water and just going for it. And it actually worked better than I thought it would. There was a little fin left
on the
bottom.
What happens when you're like jacked?
And you can I had cramps in my forearm the whole weekend.
You do look buffer on one side.
I noticed you were leaning a little bit.
Oh boy.
So, Colin, by the way, if you you want to show you're a podcast insider, when you see Lucas, just call him Lucas Half War.
Yeah, please. I'll appreciate that.
He would really like that.
Oh my goodness. And if you want to go and have water wars, I mean, let us know where we're putting in, and we'll go.
The Wetmore party started.
That's right.
We'll
have to get Ken out on the lake next. All right, so. Land acquisition. So we've done the gate. We've done, the other guy's like, yeah, this is great, but oh, so the land acquisition and as you started unpacking that, and it's like, that's a little weird if you stop to think about. It's really a double whammy if he said yes to Ruth, because now the heir that would come from the new marriage. He gets Abimelech's land, or Naomi's land, as it were. That goes to him. Then a portion of the Redeemer's estate would go to him and also be his. And he's not – well, he would be blood related to one.
Yeah.
But that just seems like – that's a crazy system. I mean, when we talked – was it 2 weeks ago about the levirate marriage?
Yeah.
And you think, well, that's a little – that's a little odd, a little different from our times, but that...
The understatement of the century.
Understatement, but...
We hope it's odd for Randy.
But just to be the complete benefactor of both in this process, that's making somebody more than whole.
Oh, yeah.
And that's really, I mean, that's really unique that I think also is as odd as what we, of the levirate marriage... in this situation than that is.
And by the way, this is one of the reasons it's really fun to talk about Christ being our kinsman redeemer, because we get out of the redemption more, not only what was lost, but more.
Mm.
And that's the, I think that's one of the really kind of cool things about this when you start as Christians, when we take this story and put the application of Christ and Boaz having... synergy there are not synergy but it's Tuesday morning, so I apparently got whatever you have, Randy.
I didn't share the fruity minty drink with you.
No,
so
you didn't.
I didn't get what
no,
you had.
No, fortunately not.
Yeah. So
Sunday was a rough day.
Sounds like it. Melody, how was your weekend? Maybe we should. Oh, no, wait. You smashed your thumb. Yeah, you electrified your thumb.
Electrified it.
Yeah.
No, I just broke a blood vessel in my thumb trying to do some electrical work. And so my thumb looks really impressively black today.
Wow.
Wow.
Many of us got hurt during the weekend.
This is a rough weekend, man.
I think I might have actually had the best weekend yet. Maybe y'all just ain't, you know, maybe the ears are missing right now.
Hmm.
Maybe we could flip that one. Got it. So coming through this whole thing and then handing over your sandal, handing over the boundaries of the property. So as soon as you get to the sandal, you're like, oh, come on, the sandal does the person that didn't hand over their sandal. Either you get ridiculed or you have to give them your sandal.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is like... I can see why there's trepidation. People are like, well, man, I really, like, if you want half one of my shoes, I kind of grow attached to them.
Probably make sure you don't wear your nicest sandals that day, right?
Right. But what if you weren't planning for battle that day?
Yeah, which I don't think the guy was, so.
It doesn't seem like it because Boaz, leaving the best for last, that was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. I wonder if he actually kept the sandal, though, or if it was like a symbolic hand. I mean, I guess if they did, they could have like forensic evidence later.
But what do I do?
Yeah, the DNA on the sandal.
What size sandal
DNA
do you wear?
On the sandal,
I'm
the trademarks.
10 and a half.
See now, if Ken and I are swapping land, I can probably do that. I'm like a 10, 10 and a half. Lucas?
I'm 11 and a half, 12.
Melanie?
Six.
All right, see, we can't swap.
That's children's too, just so you know. So that's not.
Well, wait, you wouldn't have any land anyway. So what would we be?
Right. What
would we be swapping for?
Wow. I guess I get to keep my shoes.
Congratulations.
At least you get to keep your shoe. Oh, man, that's awesome. But to walk the boundaries of the property, and, you know, as now we do things, we put in lot pins and we have GPS and we have all this stuff. And how cool, I just thought it was really cool as someone who's worked in that part of in that industry before to just like, all right, let's go. We're going to walk the boundaries of what is yours now. And also that would seemingly be an uncomfortable conversation. Like, what are you going to talk about for that whole time that you're walking around with this? If he had in fact taken the deal. And it doesn't say also why. It just seems like it really was the business transaction that this guy, the next in line Kinsman, was like, no.
Mean, well, he very clearly in Ruth 4 says this would endanger my estate. And mm-hmm. so he gives his reason for not wanting to do it. And it appears that Boaz knew that. I don't think that Boaz just showed up and was like, oh, lucky guess.
I think he was probably married and had kids of his own. And the idea of introducing a new heir that would not be an heir into that would be too complicated.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that would, I guess, just in itself create its own set of drama, probably, that you'd
imagine it would.
May or may not want. So you mentioned Perez, and through the Leveret marriage, descendant of Judah. So can we have a little more on Tamar and Judah, since it's the podcast?
I'm so glad you asked, Randy. I was dying to talk about it, just didn't have enough time.
I kind of felt that way, and I was like, look, this has got to be something we can do.
So this is
over.
Like, to me, the ultimate Leveret marriage story in the Bible, because Judah has sons, and the first son gets married, and the Bible says that he displeased God and he died. He's married to Tamar. They don't have any children. So Tamar is now married to Judah's second son.
So the first son was not Tamar's.
Say that again.
No, she didn't have any children. She married the first son. She was the wife of the first son.
Okay.
And then the first son died. So then she was a widow.
What was the first son? Do we know the first son's name? Or they
we do. And I am his, I think it was Ur.
Okay.
Ur, Onan, and Shelah are the names of his three sons. So Tamar is married to Ur.
Okay.
Ur dies. They have no children. So Judah does the Leveret marriage thing, gives Tamar to Onan. Onan, for whatever reason, decided he did not want to have children with Tamar. And so the Bible says that when he had sexual relations with Tamar, he withdrew. And yeah,
that's not allowed.
And the Bible says in biblical language said he spilled his seed on the ground.
That's where that one comes from. I knew that.
Onanism. That's where it comes from.
And this displeased God, and so Onan died, according to Genesis. And so Judah's catching on to a trend here. sons that are married to Tamar don't survive, and so he has a younger son named Shelah. And he tells Tamar, look, Shelah's too young to get married. So I want you to go stay with your family, go back home, stay with your family until my son Shelah's old enough to be married, and then we'll do that. Well, Judah's kind of like, well, maybe she'll forget about him, maybe she'll find somebody else. You know, that's kind of what the plan is. And time goes by, and Shelah is very evidently more than old enough to marry, and Judah's doing nothing about it. And I think that Tamar reaches out and says, hey,
let's be getting time.
You know, and Judah's like, no, and he just basically puts it off. So I'm not reading the story, so I'm hoping if you're reading it, make sure that I get it right here, Melanie. So basically, Tamar dresses up like a sex worker and sets up beside the road in a place that you would maybe expect to find somebody like that. And I'm just going to try to do it on my own. Just correct me if I get it wrong. Melanie's trying to hold it up so I can read it. I'll make up this. No, I'm going to tell. I think I've got the story because I truly enjoy.
Melanie, for those listening, what book of the Bible
are you reading? Genesis 38.
Okay.
So she sets up in a place that you might expect to find sex workers there. And Judah and one of his buddies it's sheep shearing time or something like that. They're out. And he decides his wife has died, so he sees the sex worker. And in those times, the sex workers actually would wear a veil, so you wouldn't actually be able to see their face. And so he goes up to the sex worker and he says, "Hey, how much?" You know, and they say, "Well, you know, we'll." And so they go, they do the act, and at the end of it, the sex worker Tamar, he doesn't know this, says, "All right, so time to pay." He goes, "Well, I don't have anything here. I mean, I'll send you a goat or a lamb from my herd. You can trust me." And she's like, "No. How do I know that you're not just gonna, you know, run off and not pay me?" He says, "Well, what do you want me to do?" And she says, "Well, I'd like you to give me your staff and your signet ring." So this is kind of the equivalent of, give me your credit card.
And your driver's license.
Give me a credit card and driver's license. That's really what it is. And which, you know, you're probably going to come back for that, right? Yeah,
exactly.
And so for whatever reason, Judas says, okay, all right, no problem. So he takes off, goes back, and then he tells his buddy, hey, take the payment. I don't want to go do that. Go take the payment to that sex worker and get them paid off. Well, his buddy goes, takes the payment, and there's nobody there. So he starts asking around. He's like, "So, hey, where would I find that?" In the Bible calls it a shrine prostitute because in those times, prostitution, that sort of thing, was often very affiliated with the cultic practices and worshiping of different gods. Mm. And so he says, "So where's that shrine prostitute that's around here?" And they're like, "Oh, we don't know. That's not a thing. There's nobody like that around here." And so he wanders around a little bit, and then he goes back to Judah and he says, I can't find her. I don't know what. And Judah's like, "Okay, well, we're just going to let this one go. We're going to look like idiots if we take it any further. So let's just go ahead and just, you know, let this go." Well,
we got to get to DMV quick.
Yeah. A couple months go by, and news comes to Judah. Hey, your daughter-in-law, Tamar, is pregnant. And Judah says, "Yes!
Oh, no.
This is fantastic news because now I have a legitimate reason to get rid of this woman. I don't have to give her to Shelah anymore. She's been unfaithful, and I can now just..." In fact, it's how horrendous this is. He's like, "Well, have her burned to death for this."
Wow.
And so... I mean, this is the penalty. So as everything's going along, Tamar tells the people that are coming for her, she says, would you take this signet ring and this staff to my father-in-law and let him know this is the person who got me pregnant?
Oh, wow. Well played.
And so Judah receives that. And Judah understandably is like, oh my. He says, okay, she is more righteous than I am, and rescinds his death sentence on her. The Bible is very clear. He says he never had sexual relations with her again, but she does have twins. She has two boys, of which one of the twins is Perez, and the other one is, oh, man, help me out.
And then twins.
Perez, Zerah. Zerah. So Perez and Zerah. And one of the interesting stories, and again, you see this happening with Jacob and Esau, but now you see with Perez and Zerah. Zerah actually starts to come out first, but then, surprise, Perez comes out, and he's the firstborn of the two twins. And so this is where the Book of Ruth decides to start its genealogy with Perez, the son of Judah, who it should have been the son of Shelah, or it should have been one of those, but that's not how that story goes. And so this is where Ruth starts their genealogy with Perez, who is going to be the main person who populates the tribe of Judah. So Judah.
This is Judah. I was going to say this. Judah was the Judah of the tribe of Judah. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. He is. Yeah.
Just in case we didn't make
one of the 12 sons of Jacob.
Wow.
And so, but then the rest of Judah really does come through Perez, and so Boaz's line comes through there.
What happens to Shelah? Do we know?
We don't know.
We don't know. So why? But why doesn't Shelah? Because. Wouldn't,
you know, sometimes the Bible's silences are just because that's not the interesting part of the story.
wouldn't Shelah still be the next?
No, he would not, because remember, it was the oldest son. So the oldest son dies. Because Tamar was the wife of the oldest son.
But wasn't Shelah the oldest son?
I feel like I'm talking about who's on first.
Was the oldest son.
Right.
He died. Then she married, or then she got together with Onan. He died.
Right.
Then but she still, was supposed to get together with Shelah.
But still, but wouldn't the Shelah. Youngest son from the first batch? He's still older than Perez.
No.
Nope.
Because the line of his oldest son.
You're right. This is a little bit like who's on first.
Yeah.
Even though it would have been more of a leveret situation because he was. He did not know this, but he was standing in for his son.
Yeah.
And therefore, that his oldest son's oldest son.
Okay. So someone totally unrelated to this.
Like, do you need me to put this down on paper for you, Randy?
Because he gets Tamar pregnant.
Right.
And unintentionally, the new son, which is the oldest of the twins.
Yes.
Supersedes the actual physically
Shelah.
Older
yeah.
Shelah.
Correct.
Correct.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Because maybe the easiest way to think about this is if had had a son,
okay,
the descendants, that's where the line
would have come from.
That would have been the direct descent from oldest to oldest to oldest. So because dies, his second son now becomes the person who's actually supposed to produce a son for and then he'll have his own children.
So Onan, that could have been Onan.
Yeah, which is probably one of the reasons why Onan did not want to have children with Tamar, because it wasn't going to be if he can get rid of Tamar, he becomes the oldest, and the descent comes through him.
Him, okay.
If Tamar never has any children, then now Onan is actually the oldest and entitled to a double portion of Judah's property, because in those times, that's the other aspect of things is the oldest. Would receive a double portion of the estate. So you know, so if all the other brothers got $50, the oldest brother got $100.
Gotcha. So if the chapters 1 through 3 shenanigans were these are the days of our lives, this is like the Wild Housewives of Judah. Like, holy cow, this is mayhem. This is Thunderdome.
So have you heard this story before?
I mean, I've read the story before, but I didn't. Obviously, the twists and turns between why we go from this lineage to then the twins was obviously lost on me.
Yeah,
I've never heard anybody actually explain that part of it.
Yeah.
The way we're talking about it now. So that's just wild.
So
that's crazy.
If you think that Jesus, if you think you have some messy relatives or ancestors,
wow,
there is a lot of messiness. And the interesting thing is, okay, so here's what's, I've actually seen, I think it's a sermon series that was called Bad Girls of the Bible or something. And it takes these women that are in Jesus' genealogy, but I think that is really misleading because the women in these stories are actually usually more righteous than the men, even though they're on Tamar's a Canaanite. Ruth is a Moabite. Rahab is a Canaanite. And yet each one of these women acts in more righteous ways than the men that are surrounding them. Judah himself says, okay, Tamar, even as messed up as this is, she was more in the right than I was. And she, you know, and so when you look at these women, they it's interesting that Matthew takes the time to make sure that he points out these particular women and the roles that they had in the genealogy of Jesus.
Well, and the writers take special care to point out, you know, Tamar was more righteous than Judah. You know, mm-hmm. Ruth was more righteous than all the other Israelite women. Yeah. You know, and I wonder if it's an attempt to sanitize the genealogy a little bit. Yes, they did all these interesting things, but they were righteous. They were more righteous than everyone else.
Yeah, I think that I'm sure there's a little aspect of that, particularly in who wrote the Book of Ruth and that sort of thing. And yet, I think it's hard to look at Ruth, coming back to Ruth, I think it's really hard to look at her story and see how she wasn't a pretty amazing person. I mean, just a really good person. She didn't have to come back with Naomi. She could have stayed in her own country, you know, with the customs, the rules, everything making sense. And yet she literally goes back with Naomi with the intent that to help Naomi survive or at least die with Naomi if that's what was going to happen. And it's a pretty selfless thing to do.
Yeah, each one of those, I mean, just like going through this, even the Tamar and like what, like you eventually paint somebody into a corner that they don't have really any other viable options other than to be like, okay, this is what you said. This, you know, I'm one way or another. But the good part does come out, like with Rahab. Who knows how she got into the sex working trade? But to also when she realizes, like, no one's likely to survive this melee by the Israelites. Everyone's afraid of them. So yeah, I'm gonna do the right thing, and I'm gonna save them. But I'm also gonna throw myself on their mercy to say, you know, remember me and my family. So.
Right. And I guess, yes, they did, you know, Ruth did faithful things. Rahab obviously did something. When I said sanitized, it was partially because they performed some really interesting acts and partially because of their heritage, of their ethnicity.
Hmm.
They had a lot more to overcome than the average biblical character.
Because that would have been a big deal that they were a Moabite, a Canaanite.
Right.
And a huge deal.
Just because you weren't, you're definitely, I mean, how does one, other than, I mean, looking at these stories, which maybe Ruth's is the most, you know, PG-friendly rating of how you become one of the.
Although chapter 3 could be.
Yeah, well, no, of course, yeah. But I mean, of what happened in order to get yourself back to the position that you needed so you had at least some leverage in these situations. Like, what did you have to do if you were Canaanite to or was there anything you could do, even as a man, if you were to be accepted in Israel circles?
Interestingly, Leviticus actually has some things to say about foreigners that are in the land and that sort of thing. It also has some specific things to say about the Canaanites and their eradication from the land. So that's one of the things where I would say you have to really read through it. And it's interesting because you see this weird balancing between things.
Yeah.
And it doesn't appear that a lot of the Canaanites were saying, hey, we want to follow Israel's God. We want to do those sort of things. But it often does appear that when they seem to want to do that, that Israel is open to that possibility.
Well, then the
and where you really start hearing the strong prohibitions from God is where God's saying, look, I don't want you to marry and then take their gods on as your gods. You know, and that was one of the things that that Balaam, who's called to curse the Israelites when they come into the land, he basically tells the king who's paying him, eventually he's like, look, if you really want to get at them and you really want to defeat them, what you need to do is you need to take your beautiful daughters and introduce them to them and then get them to follow your gods and your ways. And that's what will break their identity and break them. And that's one of the responses, too, from Moses and Joshua is, hey, don't marry, because if you do that, it's going to take you potentially away from your God. They're going to turn you away from the one true God. And that seems to be the primary concern in that marriage situation is, which way is your spouse going to turn you towards? Which way is that going to go? And in the case of Ruth and in the case of apparently Rahab, it seems that Ruth and Rahab both take on the Israelite God, that they're not keeping with their own gods from where they came from, but they turn to Yahweh, to the God of Israel.
Hmm. I think it's interesting too, because the way that they are separated out, I mean, here, you know, Israel has been warned to stay away from them, but even more so, Israel has been apparently told to wipe them out completely. Yeah. Men, women, children, animals, everything. And I think in order to commit that kind of genocide, you have to have a particular dehumanized picture of those people in your head. And for Israel, I think it wasn't just dehumanized, it was also thinking of them as moral degenerates. Mm. And so I think one of the things, when it comes to Rahab, for example, everybody else in the city died. Rahab and her family survived. And why did they survive? Well, because she was a very, very moral person who ended up in the Faith Hall of Fame. Regardless of what her occupation was or anything like that, she was separated out from the rest of the quote unquote degenerates. And so that, I think that is also when you give someone moral stature, you are also humanizing them. And I think that is part of the major distinction that has to happen.
Even with her background, it was still
right.
Given that. Because I was going to ask you that in when it comes to Ruth, who, again, Moabite, and like Ken said, she's not bringing in her gods with her. She's seemingly siding with Naomi and then likely Boaz. But is this a decision that Boaz is getting heat for because of the fact that she's a Moabite? And I mean, could that have also played into the other person? I mean, I know it says it was for the more financial, but like, oh man, I don't know if I want the heat of marrying a Moabite. Or does the fact that Ruth is an Israelite that makes it all better? Like in the construct of the social.
You mean that Naomi is an Israelite?
That Naomi's an Israelite. Does that give some like credence? Like, well, yeah, she's a Moabite, but she's with Naomi, so well, she's okay. And we trust what Boaz feels like, you know, like he's on the right path. So we'll be all right with Ruth.
If the genealogy does trace back to Rahab of Jericho, then Boaz was already half
Canaanite.
True. Yeah. Oh, that's right.
You did mention that. So maybe
who knows what ostracism he grew up with or what what's going on. The Bible doesn't say, and it does appear that he was had high stature and high honor in his society. It doesn't seem like he was a throwaway or somebody that had no honor within the town. It seems like he was highly respected there. So it's hard to say for sure. And I think that probably Rahab was probably pretty well respected within that community because of the sacrifice that she made of and the choice to go with Israel rather than to stick with her own people. And that when you read the story of Rahab, one of the things that I think is there is that Rahab actually really does believe that Israel has the one true God. She believes that their God is superior to the gods where she's at. And she acknowledges that even though she lives in this walled city, that the Israelites are going to be able to take it. And she believes that. And she believes that. And I think one of the things that we have to remember is that in those times, people didn't really just say, well, you have a superior army, therefore you will overthrow our city. If you thought your city was going to be overthrown, it's because you generally thought that the God of the people that were attacking you was superior to the God that was protecting you and was your God. And so Rahab...
And she mentions that, doesn't it? Isn't that part of the reason?
Yeah, and Rahab believes that this God is superior. Yeah. And I think that is one of the kind of the key characteristics of who Israel is willing to accept and who they're not is if the person is willing to worship only God, Yahweh God, and give up their gods, then they're more okay with things. And I think that based on the blessing of the people at the gate, it doesn't seem like they really had a big issue with Ruth being a Moabitess. They say, may she become
Rachel and Leah.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
And then may her offspring be like Perez, right?
Well, the interesting thing about that, too, is they're saying, may she be like Rachel and Leah. And Rachel actually stole gods from her father's household and took them with her when they left Laban's household and then sat on them and hid them when he came looking for them. So it's an interesting standard.
Yeah, that blessing that they're saying upon Ruth, may you prosper and be famous, and may the Lord give your descendants like those of our ancestors, Perez the son of Tamar. And I mean, that's a big deal. So obviously, whatever maybe Boaz was thought of as the Canaanite, the Moabite, and all this together. I mean, obviously she overcomes. Or they come overcome all of that as a...
And the author wants you to know it.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
author needs you to know that the people didn't have a problem with this. So why would you have a problem with it?
Wow.
That's, the whole town blessed her. Who are you to say that...
Yeah. What leg do you have to stand on?
Two generations past, who do you think you are to say that they were wrong when all these people who were there felt good about this?
Yeah. Have we talked about who wrote the book?
We did. In the first week, we talked about it a little bit, and there's a number of different theories on it. I break it into two main camps. Nobody knows who wrote the book, but it's more about why it was written and when it was written. And one camp is that it was written in King David's time to legitimize his ancestry, and basically say, yeah, I know I've got all these people, but it's cool. Look at all you fools. I mean, all of you come from Tamar, you're not, and a lot of you come from probably Rahab. So, and now look, Ruth, she was an incredible woman. Look, and all the people in town blessed her. So we don't have any issue with my ancestry. The fact that I have some mixed race here in me and that I'm not pure Israelite, that's not a problem. So that's one theory. Another theory is that this was written after the exile to Babylon. And when the Israelites come back to to Israel, to the land, to Jerusalem, their leaders get really upset with them because there's been a lot of intermarriage while they were in Babylon. There's been a lot of people marrying people. And the people that were left behind in Judah and in Israel, they've married people from the land. And so there's a lot of intermarriage. There's the purity. A lot of the purity is gone. And so the leadership gets really upset to the point that I think the Bible says that one of the leaders pulls the hair out of the beards of these men and gets like starts yelling at them and says, "You know, we've done a bad thing. God's been very clear. Don't you remember Solomon marrying all those foreign wives and what it did to him? And you know, we can't be doing this." And so the leader demands that these people divorce their wives and send them away with their kids. And so there's some who conjecture that one of the priests at that time who may have been intermarried wrote this book as a, "Hey guys, this isn't something that's as big a deal as you're trying to make it here.
Out to be, yeah.
You know, if it was good enough for David's line, why isn't it, you know, why are we going to be sending our wives and kids away? This doesn't seem like the right way to do things." So there's some who conjecture that might be one of a writer of it afterwards as well. And some of the language that's used in the book matches up better to the language in the time of the post-exile than it does David's time. So that's another clue that some people, some scholars will point to. There's other scholars that will say, yeah, that language is used a little bit in David's time. And there's nothing to say that that language might not have been updated from the original when things got transcribed. So there's, again, it's just one of those interesting theological discussions. And the question is, for us today in 2025, how does Ruth speak to us today? And what, even though it wasn't written to us, it's been written for us. Mm-hmm. And so how do we take this book and apply it to the world that we live in and to the things that are happening to us today? How do we take this book and say, levirate marriage isn't something any of us are really thinking about right now here in the United States?
Yeah.
You know, we're not thinking about...
Yet.
Well, who knows? You know, who knows? But we have all these things that are very different. So how do we take this story and how do we make it, how do we hear God speaking us today and what do we hear God saying to us through this story?
Yeah. No, I think one of the ways is just, I really liked how you had taken chapter one, here's adversity, chapter four, here's the conclusion, there's hope, there's wealth again, there's safety, there's a plan moving forward that things have gone really well, there's disaster, there's triumph, there's all these different things. And it makes you just stop and think about how many times you've been in chapter one of situation in your life, and you may not even see that there could be a chapter two or three. And four, if you didn't know it was coming, it's like, but that's a long way to wait for chapter four to figure out how God's going to work it out. But then also, how many times if you flip it around, are you in chapter four and you look back and go, man, that was like that all had to happen. And it was definitely God, you know, teaching me a lesson or me learning something that I needed to know or whatever, or it was beneficial to someone else. And sometimes that's a hard one. But thinking about if you happen to be in that place, it's a good thing to just stop and think about, you know, think about each spot where they were and probably how hopeless at certain points it probably felt like, maybe to both Naomi and to Ruth. And then I really liked, you said, you know, was Rahab the sex worker, is the mother of Boaz. She's half Canaanite, half Israelite, maybe a little more sympathetic to a woman in a hard place, and maybe understanding the importance to being faithful to a promise being made. And I was like, whoa, that's if you stop and think about it. And again, in going back to that one in four chapters, you know, sometimes when you look at your life and you think, man, well, I didn't have the advantage because I had this, and this is in my chapter one or chapter two. And this is another way that it's like, maybe back then Boaz, had some issues growing up and who his mother was and all of this. But in the end, God uses it. And you know, Obed, you mentioned their lineage. And you said Jesus' lineage is from all nations of the world, and Jesus is a blessing to all of humanity. And it was like, oh, man, that makes you feel good in just thinking about kind of where, like you said, how does it come to us today? And that, you know, people from all over the world, Jesus is a blessing to all of humanity. We like to think sometimes it's just us and our little bubble and our theology, our ideology, all that. And it's just, it's a good reminder that Jesus is a blessing to all of humanity. I thought that was really, really cool. So Lucas, do we have any questions?
Yeah, we have two.
All right.
So the first one is from Erin. She says, I like how Boaz tells about the land first. Then after the guy is like, yeah, I want it. Then Boaz is like, oh, and by the way, there is Ruth. Why did he lead with the land and wait to mention Ruth?
It would appear that he was putting out there probably what most people would have thought was the most important part of it. And I think there was a little bit of a bait and switch mm-hmm. for him that he here's the land, do you want it? And then, oh, and by the way, Ruth, I don't know. It feels pretty clever on his part. Do you have any?
Yeah, I think the same thing. I think it was, you know, I think the initial, oh, yes, I want to do this. And then that little tiny sucker punch at the end. I think that it also made for a really good story.
Yeah.
Yeah. And on the same note, Tisinko asked, considering this is a normal thing in that culture, might the fact that Ruth was a Moabite and her children will possibly be considered pagan by this guy, could you talk about how that may have made a difference in his decision and how that differs from Boaz?
Yeah, I'm not 100%. I'm a little less clear on whether her being a Moabitess had anything to do with him not wanting to do it.
Okay.
The Bible isn't particularly clear. Could it have been a thing? It could have been. If I were just from my side of things, if I'm thinking through it, I think what Melanie said a little earlier, that it seems really likely that he already had a wife and children of his own. And so he was a lot more worried about his lineage being messed up and his estate, losing estate and that sort of thing for the children he already has. And so I tend to think that it's a little bit more of that, a little bit less. In fact, I really think that the author of Ruth kind of goes out of their way to kind of normalize and to not make it seem like it's a big deal that Ruth was a Moabitess. I mean, really downplays any kind of disdain that the community would have for Ruth. There's no discussion of the women talking around the local well about, oh, you know, that Ruth showed up and, you know, who is she? You know, there's no discussion of that in the book. And if the author wanted to include something like that, they certainly could have, if that was the case. But I think that I really do think that this came down to a purely financial situation for that nearest kinsman redeemer. And for Boaz, as I said in my sermon, I really think it came down to him wanting to do the right thing by two women who were in a hard spot, that were in a bad place, and to also to remember what it means to be faithful to the responsibilities that you have in life. And I think, you know, in many ways, maybe it was a good thing that the nearest kinsman redeemer said no. Maybe it was a better situation for Boaz than it was for him. So maybe we shouldn't throw too much shade at this guy for not doing it. On the other hand, you have the difference between a business deal and somebody who's doing something not for business, but to take care mm-hmm. of responsibilities and to display faithfulness.
Yeah. Well, and the one thing I want to finish up with Philippians, because I thought that, you know, Ken was talking about, you know, how much names matter, and that was a really cool tie-in. But before we get there, someone sent me an email to podcast@wholelife.church, And they said they had a question. I don't know who it was. It was an email address that wouldn't give away someone's name. So if you're listening, please resend the email. It was from a past episode about 6 months ago. And they had a very specific question. And I swear I did not delete the email, but I cannot find it anywhere. So I'm not sure what happened to it. But if you have a question, if you're listening to episodes a little bit later and you have a question you'd like an answer to it, send it to us and we can go back and just see what it was about and do that. Because I don't want you to think that, well, it's already passed, so I can't ask it. So definitely 407-965-1607. You can text or voicemail or podcast at wholelife.church. So if you are listening, please resend that question because we'll go back and find the episode and then I'll make sure that Ken and Melanie get a chance to check it out beforehand. That way we don't have to try to do it on the fly and make it weird. And we'll make sure.
Why would we change up our normal way of doing things?
I like weird sometimes, but you know, just to make sure that they have time to check it out. And
just
we
so
will
that Ken can remember what it was he preached on six months ago.
Yeah, well, there's, you know, I don't expect, yeah.
Sometimes I'm surprised on the topics I cover. So, and as is Randy, apparently. Randy asked when I was going to get around to preaching on Revelation. So
Daniel.
Oh, Daniel. Was it Daniel?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah. That was what, last week? I'm like,
I was expecting a Daniel
no,
for this
no.
year.
We met with one of my friends, Xavier, and Lucas and I do a creative day every other week on Thursday. We spend a couple hours and we leave the office, we disconnect, and we try to work on projects that need our creativity. That just doesn't happen when people are opening your door and doing all that. And we had an artist friend of mine who we would love to have him help us do some graphic work or some maybe for some series or maybe incorporate into the worship service. Really, really fun. And we had a great time together kind of dreaming about a few things. And I was like, oh, man, you'd be perfect. Would be like Daniel. And so I was like, I think we're doing Daniel this year.
Sorry, pal.
So, Zave, if you're listening, sorry, bro. That was last year.
I think you'd be artistically more interested in the second half of Daniel than the first half.
Yeah, so it was like, sorry, it's, you know, sometimes I thought it was a good idea, and I was pretty sure I remembered that Daniel was upcoming, but that's only, that was probably.
It was a great idea. That's why we ended it last year.
So, when you get to the end of the message, Ken was going through what the names mean and that names matter, and we went through the genealogy, so. And how those matched up in Matthew versus Ruth. So definitely go back and check out the message. But in the idea of names matter, he went to Philippians 2, verses 6 through 8. And it says, though he was God, he did not think of equality with God as something to cling to, meaning Jesus. Instead, he gave up his divine privileges. He took the humble position of a slave and was born as a human being. When he appeared in human form, he humbled himself in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on a cross. Therefore, God elevated him to the place of highest honor and gave him the name above all other names, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under earth, and every tongue declare that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. I just thought that was a really cool verse and a really awesome way to kind of tie that all together and just with that name and that Jesus. And then and Jesus being a benefit to everyone, to all nations, is just something really great to think about as you as we finish this out and what Jesus' name means and just who he is. So next week, are we back to the Voice of Whole Life?
No. This next week we're going to have a Memorial Day sermon.
It's already Memorial Day.
Yep. And then the week after that, we have a Voices of Whole Life with Amanda Maggard. Yeah.
Ooh.
And then we have our summer series.
That's right. And speaking of summer, wholelife.church/events, VBS, summer party, registrations open for all of the, for VBS. We need volunteers, adult volunteers, help. I think you said to help make it a high quality event. I think that was a good idea. It's always good to see. It's always good to see your fellow church members here during VBS to kind of help out and help the kids have a great time. So if that fits you, please do go to wholelife.church/VBS. That's where registration is open there. And then don't miss, like, start checking stuff off for summer party. We got some really cool things coming this summer.
June 1, Sunday.
It's close.
Yeah, it's coming right up, and we have a bunch of, we've rented a bunch of water inflatables that are going to be here at the church. It's going to be incredible. Whether you're a kid or not a kid,
yeah,
you're going to have a good time. And we are opening up one of the rooms inside the church for board games and games and stuff like that. But come out for that. It is going to be a really good time.
The Italian ice pops. Don't forget.
There's that. So we have all kinds of really fun things happening this summer that are going to be really amazing.
That's less than 2 weeks away.
I know. Can you believe it?
Man, I haven't told Sparkle yet. And so if you see her, don't tell her about the inflatables, or I'm going to be listening to every day. We're going to have to count down how many days it is until water inflatables. And I just got done for three days.
I can't wait to see her. Yeah.
It was just
be sure to ask your dad.
Yeah. Kayaking with Carol and Lucas, and then we went to SeaWorld on Sunday with Lucas, and she was counting down every day until she was going to hang out with her friends. And so, you know, it's okay.
It's cute.
How many days? So how many days till the next podcast? Exactly 7 if you're listening on Wednesday.
Yeah. So I will not be with you next week.
Ken, who's preaching?
Well, I'm preaching this Sabbath, and then the following Sabbath, Amanda will be preaching.
And so are you vacation?
I'm taking a little vacation.
Hot dog.
That's why Ken won't tell me what he's preaching about next week, because he's going to do something really controversial and then go on vacation and we're going to deal with
radio silence.
Enjoy talking about it during the podcast. There's going to be a lot of questions, but I won't know what they are.
Okay, so let's open this up then. You know, it's not often we have an extra microphone just hanging around and whatever. So next week, if you would like to be part of the podcast, and if you could be here at 9 a.m. on a Tuesday morning, let me know and maybe we can make that happen. Randy at wholelife.church.
You have to answer all the hard questions.
That's right. So be prepared. Like, take
Melanie
notes.
Will help you. Melanie will take all the hard questions. You just... Yeah, she'll do that. She just
maybe if you can keep me on, if you can keep me on the straight and narrow and on a linear path next week, maybe that's your job. Anyway, 407-965-1607 or podcast for life, wholelife.church. Let us know. So, guys, thanks for listening and have a great week.